Sandoz, for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. My topic is Theodore Roosevelt as statesman, character and citizenship in a republic. Neither Bacon nor Locke was he, but we will proceed nevertheless. The legacy of Roosevelt as statesman is inseparable from the vigorous, changing, and often rambunctious nation that he so well personified at the turn of the century. His 7 years as president following the assassination of William McKinley in 1901 were a decisive period in American history. Theodore Roosevelt was the first president who knew that the United States had come of age, that not only were they no longer colonies of Europe and no longer an immature offshoot on the periphery of Western civilization, but that they had become a world power with a distinctive national interest that could not overlook momentous developments in Europe and Asia. He and political allies like Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts and Alfred Thayer Mahan at the Naval War College were among the first to develop a kind of strategic vision for America, one that acknowledged America's role in the world would be fraught with new responsibilities, but also with new dangers. In addition, Roosevelt was no ordinary apostle of realpolitik who had simply become America's own Bismarck. Although he was no stranger to the exercise of presidential power and the traditional methods of diplomacy, foreign policy could not, in his mind, be separated from the growth and the development of the American Union. He was among the first to prepare the country both spiritually and physically for this uncertain but inescapable new destiny as a great power. The outward symbol of that tremendous national awakening was the Panama Canal, which he created because he had the historic insight to see that it was the vital link needed to complete what he called the winning of the West. A Walter Lippmann, for whom Roosevelt became the image of a great leader and a prototype of presidents, remarked in 1935 that the canal, as seen from the perspective of time, would assume even greater stature and importance because it consummated the building of a nation and marked its entry upon the stage of world affairs. So, obligations to others could not be separated from obligations to ourselves. This simply reaffirming an overriding theme in Washington's farewell address. But what Roosevelt actually did as leader and as reformer was sometimes less important than just how he went about doing it. The 1990s is not the only decade to know an American president in the hectic mode of perpetual campaigner. But let me suggest that the historic analogy abruptly ends there. Roosevelt's campaign would be of a different sort. There was, in his defense of American political ideas, more of the preacher than the politician. After all, this was the clamorous prophet who at the Republican National Convention in 1912 admonished his disciples in no uncertain terms, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord." By 1915, 3 days after the sinking of the Lusitania, and after Woodrow Wilson shared his solemn judgment that there is such a thing as a nation being too proud to fight, Roosevelt called upon the faithful to fear God and take your part in the defense of democratic ideals in the Great War. Of course, this talk about Armageddon was thoroughly in character. Leave it to Roosevelt to place himself at the center of the biggest battle in the history or the future of heaven and earth. There's certainly an Old Testament flavor to the homilies sprinkled throughout so many of his speeches about American duties. One might even imagine that Isaiah himself could have cried them out concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of kings. Again, like Isaiah, they were addressed to men in the mass, to a nation, to a civilization, to an age. As to the quality of these political sermons, their form is not rhetorically distinctive, nor is the language in the dissertation itself beautiful or even particularly eloquent. One discovers here no fine-spun theology or philosophies of life. There are no schemes of redemption, plans of atonement, and no soft amenities of free grace. Over and over again, the recurrent theme is hammered into the mind and the heart of the multitude. Be good, live for righteousness, fight for righteousness, and if need be, die for it. Nothing else quite seems to matter but to be militantly decent. Well, some were converted and others hooted. Roosevelt had discovered the Ten Commandments. A New York editor suggested that Roosevelt moved about the state always with a pulpit concealed on his person. Easy all of this is to parody, but not so easy to ignore and not so easy to forget. And while as abstract truth, Roosevelt's preaching, "Be decent and you will count," was as old as the hills, when transformed into applied ethics in American business and commercial life, it was something of a new and dangerous creed. It was stirring up people. The language was simple. The multitude could understand. The response to Roosevelt and his message was instantaneous, and the great revival was on. One must not forget that Roosevelt's sermon were a kind of segue to his sponsoring new laws and institutional changes of government. Along with the uproar about righteousness came the Roosevelt policies. The discovery of the Ten Commandments was not as innocent as it looked. The simplicity of the moralities was to be the foundation on which this political leader was attempting to build a rather complicated and unfinished structure of what he called industrial and social justice. But beyond the ordinary collisions, political collisions of his day, there was a voice from Roosevelt's soul that knew how to move people better than his conscious reasoning could explain, a certain capacity to understand the needs of the time. Now, the same fundamental insight into the truth that a new period of American maturity had opened made Theodore Roosevelt perhaps the first president who clearly realized that national stability and social harmony had to be sought deliberately and had consciously to be maintained. Of course, there were other social reformers and pioneers before him. However, as president, he grasped the elemental fact that justice, opportunity, prosperity were not assigned to Americans forever as a free gift of providence. He believed that once the era of frontier expansion had come to an end, the promise of American political life could only be realized by a national effort. He knew the history of other nations. He knew the pathology of other nations, the exhaustion of natural resources, the deterioration of agriculture, the accumulation of wealth and congestion of poverty, the concentration of power, and the concentration of proletarian masses in new urban settings. He strived, as president, to awaken the American people to the knowledge that they had come into a time when to ensure a good life for their descendants, they must brace themselves to what he would come to call a new nationalism. Now, this new nationalism, if examined in all of its details, I would suggest, is not a rigid ideological or doctrinaire manifesto of expansive government led by a dangerous man on horseback. His outlook was far from a mundane celebration of the bigness of government or welfare statism. What many critics, as well as some of T.R.'s supporters, overlooked is how he looked to the individual qualities of citizenship as the moral lifeline of Republican government. The quality of government and life simply mirrored the interests and achievements of individual citizens. Success or failure depended on the way average men and women fulfill their duties and responsibilities, not just in the ordinary and everyday affairs of life, but also, he believed, in crises that called forth the heroic virtues. Now, I would like to quarrel a little bit with Henry Adams' characterization of his friend Theodore Roosevelt, the idea that he showed the singular quality that belongs to ultimate matter, the quality that medieval theology assigned to God. He was pure act. This is a revealing half-truth at best. Theodore Roosevelt simply could not be still. There was a juvenile restlessness to this man. At the same time, though, his writings reveal a mind alive to the vitalities of human nature, as well as to the notion that political ethics is an endless quest for what is right amid the complexity of competing and sometimes compatible moral ends. For example, Roosevelt had read and was particularly drawn to Aristotle's Politics and Ethics. He drew upon the insight that the basis of good citizenship began not in duties by and for the state, but in the fundamental relationships of the household. For him, the family was everything in the state. The family was to be the foundation for all moral and political duties that radiated outward through faith and friendship into the larger political community. It is noteworthy that Roosevelt expressed the view, time and time again, that the main source of national power, national greatness, was not what could be accomplished by the force of arms abroad. Rather, it would be found in the average citizenship of the nation as it was directed toward the well-being of a free people. Perhaps we are not entitled to retain the full measure of our self-respect, much less the respect of other nations, if we lack confidence in the integrity and the strength of our citizenship. At the same time, Roosevelt found a common ethical bond uniting good citizens and good statesmen, and that was the issue of character. In the battles of life, no intellectual or physical achievement counted to him quite as much as the various moral and civic virtues that define good character. If raw courage or intellect at its highest is not regulated by a moral sense, he once wrote, then they can too easily become the instruments of unscrupulous force and cunning. If the strong man, Roosevelt's man in the arena, whose face is marred by sweat and blood, does not have within himself the lift that comes from devotion to loftier ideals, then he becomes a menace both within the household and to society at large. By character, Roosevelt had in mind the sum of those qualities that relate to an individual's force and discipline, his or her good faith and sense of honor, self-respect, common sense, the power of accepting individual responsibility, and yet acting in conjunction with others. These were to be the hallmarks of an honest and an upright citizenry. Without them, he thought, no people can control themselves or save themselves from being controlled by others from the outside. Similarly, Roosevelt argued that the duties of citizenship apply to those external responsibilities by which the government interacts with other nations in world politics. America's mistakes just after the Great War and in the decades thereafter turned partly on the fact that we did not awake soon enough to our new role in the world, perhaps. He made the case for principled realism in foreign policy, whereby power and ideals need not defeat one another. The war hero at San Juan Hill, the author of the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, and later the geopolitical patron of the Great White Fleet, had another side to his statecraft. He was also the individual who won the first Nobel Peace Prize in 1906 for brokering an end to the war between Russia and Japan, who in that same year acted as go-between for the Germans and the French at the Algeciras Conference, which contained the crisis over Morocco, and who, along with Secretary of State Elihu Root, helped to bring the second Hague Peace Conference to fruition in 1907. A rather dubious track record, perhaps, for one noted in some quarters to be a brutal warmonger. Material and military well-being, he suggested to an audience at the Sorbonne in 1910, is little more than a people's foundation for safety. That foundation, although indispensable, is worthless unless upon it is raised the structure of a higher life. War, he finally got round to acknowledging, is a dreadful thing, admittedly. And unjust war, he said, is a crime against humanity. But it is a crime because it is unjust, not because it is war. The question for the leader should not simply be, is there to be peace or war? Another question worth asking is it right to prevail? Reasonable efforts could be made by diplomats and others to keep nations from war, or in some cases to arbitrate their differences. But no self-respecting nation, he counseled, any more than the self-respecting individual ought to submit to wrong or unprovoked injury. Now, with due regard to Dr. Johnson, patriotism is not necessarily the last refuge for either the scoundrel or Theodore Roosevelt. He rejected the assumption that patriotic regard for national ideals is inconsistent with a proper regard for the rights and interests of other nations. Honor, prestige, credibility, all vital ingredients of diplomacy and power, require that one's nation neither inflict nor suffer wrongdoing. At the same time, the very weakness of international law, the structure of international politics itself, makes it a profound error to substitute abstract humanitarian and legal causes for a prudent reckoning of the national interest. Foreign policy is neither theology or social work. So, yes, a wise statesman may justly encourage various movements and efforts that seek to substitute peaceful procedures for the violent resolution of conflicts. But that wise statesman, if he is also prudent and honest, will understand that the cause of international morality will not count for much if he has neither the power nor the will to answer the misdeeds of tyrants and what we have come to call of late rogue nations. Ideals should be high, but not so high as to make it impossible to achieve them. Clearly, Roosevelt would be troubled, perhaps surprised, by a tendency in today's polarized debate to assume that one is either a Machiavellian realist or a steadfast believer in norms and values, and never the twain shall meet. Now, this might be acceptable for academic parlor games, but it can be a disaster in foreign policy. On the one hand, American values have a certain universal or perennial quality. People want to say freely what they think, worship as they are so inclined, and elect, along with the Electoral College, the people who are to govern them. On the other hand, and as Roosevelt understood in his own day, the triumph of those values is assuredly easier when the international balance of power favors those who believe in them. But sometimes that balance of power takes time to achieve. Part of Roosevelt's legacy in politics and diplomacy is that means and ends should not be separated, that we undertake no policies that we are not prepared to pay for. Finally, one last and perhaps controversial component of Roosevelt's work as statesman was his crusade for what he called Americanism. At certain points, it would have its harsh and uncompromising side with concern about hyphenated Americans whose loyalty was sometimes unfairly questioned. But at the same time, he steered clear of slavish conformity to a party line, or exact knowledge about the counsels of the Almighty. He could think of no greater threat to Republican government than the demagogue who would politically seek to divide citizens along the lines of race, class, or religion. Such a person, in his eyes, forfeited their worth as a man or a woman, as a loyal citizen, insofar as they are transformed into proxy agents of parochial causes. So for Roosevelt, there was a sense that American unity is plural, that it can be preserved only by a continuing equilibrium among many regions, interests, and faiths, each moderately and tolerantly pursued, perhaps. There will always be a fragile balance in society. On the one hand, accommodating intensity of conviction with a broad tolerance of difference of conviction on the other hand. But bitter, internecine class hatreds are not signs of earnest beliefs so much as they are the manifestation of a gloomy bigotry. Perhaps Roosevelt would remind us that ruin looks us in the eye when we judge a man or a woman by their position or rank instead of judging them by their conduct in that position. Thank you and good morning.